Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
This is Bloomberg Law with June Grosso from Bloomberg Radio.
It's the 29th lawsuit brought by Texas to challenge Biden administration policies. And this week, the Supreme Court justices seemed divided over the administration shifting its deportation priorities. The law meant reality when the justices were confronted with the fact that Congress has never provided the funds that would be needed to arrest and deport all of the estimated 11 million undocumented immigrants in the U.S., despite what the law says. Here are the Chief Justice and Justice Brett Kavanaugh.
Now, it's our job to say what the law is, not whether or not it can be possibly implemented or whether there are difficulties there. And I don't think we should change that responsibility just because Congress and the executive can't agree on something that's possible to address this problem. I don't think we should let them off the hook.
I'm just trying to figure out how this will play out if you were to prevail. So the government says we don't have the money to comply. Then what do you do?
And Justice Elena Kagan questioned the right of states like Texas to challenge and frequently block every new immigration policy.
Immigration policy is supposed to be the zenith of federal power, and it's supposed to be the zenith of executive power. And instead, we're creating a system where a combination of states and courts can bring immigration policy to a dead halt.
My guest is immigration law expert Leon Fresco, a partner at Holland & Knight. Leon, there are several issues going on in this case. Explain the basics for us.
Well, this case is about a memorandum that was issued by the Biden administration that said that they're going to prioritize basically violent offenders, national security risks, and very, very recent border crossers as the people they're prioritizing for removal. And everybody else would be deprioritized for removal, including some people and people with certain criminal convictions, that the statute would require that they be detained and removed if they were apprehended by ICE. Because the idea of the memo is that even though some people might nominally fit these categories, such as someone, for instance, who stole a chocolate bar from a store, that individual in the parameters of all of the equities might not be someone you would want to remove if they had five U.S. citizen children and were the sole breadwinner for that family. And so that memo says to look into all of that information and make a decision. And what the state of Texas is doing is it's challenging that memo, saying that at the end of the day, there shouldn't be any discretion to deprioritize anybody from removal. I find someone, they should remove someone. End of the story. No further discussion.
The first question is a threshold question, whether Texas has standing or the legal right to challenge the administration's guidelines.
Correct. The court was actually very concerned about this fact, because what they were looking at was, first of all, under the Administrative Procedure Act, did someone have to be specially affected? And even Justice Alito sort of said, you know, specially offended, I think was the term he used, to have standing, as opposed to what states have been doing previously and what the courts have been ruling previously, that states get what was called a special solicitude, which is they get a little bit of an exception from standing because they have these interests in terms of all of their state residents that they could bring that perhaps any individual resident couldn't bring. And so the court was talking about that issue, But then the court was also talking about, well, what about, is Texas actually affected even if you make them give a standing analysis? So first of all, do they even have to have one? Can they just have this special solicitude to sue? But if they have to have one, well, what about their justification that they gave that their health care costs are going to be higher because of this memo that deprioritizes people? And at the end of the day, that's sort of such a speculative claim, because I don't think there's any economic analysis that really works these things out in terms of a very large picture. I mean, you sort of have, in general, more people equals more GDP equals more government revenue, and then you have to figure out where each person is from the point of view of how much they take. And does standing require that kind of analysis, or does it require just a harm irrespective of the benefit? And so they're trying to weigh all of that. But I think they will continue by allowing the standing. I think that's ultimately not going to be the issue where this case gets decided. I think the court will do something it familiarly does in many cases, which is it will assume but not decide that Texas has standing and punt that issue for another day and get to other issues in this case, probably.
Another issue, perhaps the issue, is that the law says that some immigrants, quote, shall be taken into custody or removed.
Correct. There's a law called INA Section 236B, or Title 8 U.S. Code 1226B, depending on where you're looking in the statute, that says that there's a specific type of foreign national, if you commit certain types of crimes, you have to be detained mandatorily and removed from the country. And so there was some gradation there with Amy Coney Barrett and Neil Gorsuch, where they were saying to the Department of Justice, well, look, maybe you have this broad power for people you haven't detained and you don't know anything about it. They're just your run-of-the-mill undocumented person that overstayed their visa or that crossed the border unlawfully 10 years ago. But that's different than when you literally know of somebody who's one of these 236B foreign nationals who has a criminal conviction. What gives you the authority to have a memo that deprioritizes people within that category when Congress clearly said prioritize people in that category? And so there, I can see a compromise decision which strikes maybe that part of the memo, but says that the administration has broad discretion with regard to people such as border crossers and visa overstays to figure out what groups of those people to prioritize or not prioritize, given that there isn't sufficient funds for all of those people.
Some of the justices, particularly the Chief Justice, said shall is shall, and we follow the law. We don't decide how the law is going to be implemented, but then questioned how you could force the government into doing something it just doesn't have the money to do.
I think there was a very interesting philosophical debate that Justice Roberts was saying, which is, look, at the end of the day, there isn't probably funding to enforce any law. But the point is, that's a different question than whether the government can exempt people. So, you know, you say we're going to exempt this group of tax offenders from tax prosecution, or this group of labor law offenders from labor law prosecution. Sure, you don't have enough money to prosecute every labor law violator, but that's a different thing than writing a memo for people. And so what Justice Roberts says is, look, can we just say there's a world where you can't write a memo, but you just do your best within the limited constraints that you have? And I think that is an important discussion, but then it gets balanced with the question of, okay, let's say that's true. What now? What does the agency do now? Do you actually let it sort of run as this rudderless agency without any priorities? Or does the state of Texas actually get to write the priorities for ICE? Or does a judge get to write the priorities for ICE and force them to deport specific people? And I think that's where this thing falls apart. That's where I think you'll see a cobbled together coalition of justices say, look, you can't write a memo that deprioritizes people that Congress prioritized, aka people with certain criminal convictions. But within the categories of people where there's clearly not enough funding, those you can actually create a prioritization given the historical basis of immigration law and the broad authority it gives to the federal government, the executive branch, to deal with these issues.
So, Leon, what happened to the federal government being in charge of immigration policies, not the states?
Well, I think that's going to be the underlying issue here. And I think you're going to get a cobbled together group of justices. You already had Justice Coney Barrett, who would have granted an injunction in the first place. So now the question is, can you get, I don't think you're going to get Alito. I don't think you're going to get Thomas. I don't think you're going to get Kavanaugh. But can you get either one of Roberts or Gorsuch to come along to the principle of, fine, even if we say that this memo is unlawful, what's the remedy really at the end of the day? Are we going to have a court system that dictates to the federal government what they do vis-a-vis immigration enforcement? No, of course not. And so because of that, what we're going to do is we're going to basically write out the little section of this memo that we think actually violates the statute, the one that basically tells people to deprioritize even the people with criminal convictions, but give broad latitude during the rest of the group of people who are basically 11 million border crossers and visa overstays, that they be prioritized into groups where some are more serious and some are less serious.
I thought it was really interesting that Justice Kagan brought out the fact that has been forum shopping for judges that will issue nationwide injunctions in these cases.
In Texas, there are divisions within districts. You can pick your trial court judge. You play by the rules. That's fine. But you pick your trial court judge, one judge stops a federal immigration policy in its tracks.
It's certainly an issue that no matter who's doing it needs to be addressed, and there perhaps needs to be three-judge panels that get convened in cases where people are challenging the constitutionality of something. But in the end, that won't be the basis upon which this case is decided.
You've given hints here and there, but tell us what you think the decision will be.
Based on the oral argument, I think they will say, we will assume without deciding that they're standing. We will say that at the end of the day, we're not going to get to the issue here as to whether a vacatur is the same thing as an injunction, because all we're going to do here is we're going to say that this memo can survive, but no part of the memo can survive moving forward if it conflicts with a federal statute. And so the parts of the memo that conflict with the shall detain part have to be written again, and we're going to leave that to the district court to figure out which parts conflict with that, something like that I could see happening. And then we will see where that goes moving forward. But I think that's where this is likely to go. I think they're likely to punt a lot of the big issues. I could be proven wrong, and that would certainly not be the first time, but, you know, it would take one justice moving away from where they were in previous court decisions to do this. So we'll see if that ends up being the way. But I think given what we saw in the Remain in Mexico case, I think you'll see a practical five-judge coalition created that basically allows the federal government to create these priorities, but not for places where they clearly conflict with statute.
Thanks, Leon. That's Leon Fresco of Holland & Knight. Coming up, FTX investors sue celebrities. This is Bloomberg.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
I call it the wheel.
I don't think so.
What does it do?
It grows.
Yeah, so does a bagel, okay? A bagel you can eat.
One of the worst ideas I've ever heard.
Larry David played a skeptic about FTX in a Super Bowl ad that went viral. And it turned out it was smart to treat the cryptocurrency platform's claims with skepticism. But David is now being sued for luring unsophisticated investors into the FTX debacle. And he's not the only celebrity. Tom Brady, Gisele Bündchen, Shaquille O'Neal, and Steph Curry are also being sued, and some of their endorsements were more straightforward.
Okay, quit messing around, man. Give me some tips on crypto.
No.
But you are an expert, right?
No, I'm not an expert, and I don't need to be. With FTX, I have everything I need to buy, sell, and trade crypto safely.
My guest is Shane Cipini, founder of Cipini LLP. There are lots of people to sue here, lots of entities as well. So why sue celebrities, some with a tenuous connection to what happened?
I think what's going on here mostly is that the celebrities aren't individually bankrupt. So if the plaintiffs were to sue FTX, that lawsuit would be paused during the pendency of the bankruptcy, or at least for parts of the bankruptcy. And you don't have that same issue if you sue somebody like Shaquille O'Neal, who is certainly not bankrupt.
Is there also an added factor of drawing attention to the lawsuit?
I think there is definitely an aspect of wanting to draw attention to the lawsuit by bringing in people whose names are regularly in the news. For example, I don't think that Larry David was included in this lawsuit necessarily because the claims against him are particularly strong, but rather because he was a participant in one of the most popular and widely shared Super Bowl ads of all time. I don't think that's a coincidence.
The celebrity's liability depends on whether the products they promoted are securities. Tell us more about that.
Securities law is something that's developed over hundreds of years to protect the investing public from the exact types of issues that have arisen in the wild, wild west of cryptocurrency trading. They're there to make sure that when people are promoting stocks and other types of securities, that what they're promoting actually is real and actually exists and isn't just a complete sham or a fraud. And if it turns out that it is a sham or a fraud, then the investing public has some modicum of protection, at least. And so basically, you have everybody other than crypto boosters who say that cryptocurrencies should or are securities. They have many of the hallmarks of a traditional security. The problem is that people who boost crypto say what's great about it is the lack of regulation. So to the extent that they are found to be securities, it's a big problem for the cryptocurrency industry as a whole, because it will bring them under much tighter and, in my opinion, much needed regulatory scrutiny.
And the Securities and Exchange Commission has indicated that it thinks they're securities. So let's say they're found to be securities. What are the implications?
The securities should have been registered with the state so that they could be reviewed and monitored and regulated for compliance of all types of different consumer protection laws. The reason, I think, from a legal perspective, why they're bringing unregistered security actions rather than, say, outright fraud, is with a fraud action, they would have to prove knowledge on the part of the celebrities as well as intent to defraud the consumers. And from all of the reporting that I've seen and read, it was Sam Bankman-Fried and maybe only a few other people who had any intimate knowledge of what was actually going on at the company. So that would be a much harder hill to climb than just saying these are actually securities. They, in fact, were not registered. And then when they were marketed, they were illegally marketed as unregistered securities, whether the celebrity knew that at the time or not.
So now, does it matter the kind of commercial? I mean, we talked, Larry David was actually saying, you know, I don't buy it. And, you know, the Golden State Warriors are named. They unveiled the company's logo on the court at the team's arena. But then other celebrities, you know, promoted it more directly.
I think it does depend on how they were promoted. Putting the name of a company up on something or saying, you know, they're the official sponsor of Golden State Warriors or whatever, you know, that's a far cry from somebody specifically saying, you know, they have these yield-bearing accounts. These are great. You basically earn free money for nothing. Those kinds of statements are very different. And the thrust of your question, I think, is correct, that there's going to be a much harder time showing that link between the yield-bearing accounts, if they are deemed to be securities, and commercial activity like naming something after FTX or doing a commercial where the celebrity like Larry David states, you know, no thanks, I'll pass on this. But that said, I mean, those commercials were all about getting people to put money into the yield-bearing account. It's not like FTX ran the Larry David commercial to scare people away from their company. They did it because they know that he's like, you know, the curmudgeon that everybody loves to disagree with.
So what might the celebrity's defense be at trial?
I mean, it's unlikely that any of these cases will get before a jury. But if they did, the kind of argument they would make, like, look, we had no idea. And even if we had done reasonable due diligence, we couldn't have figured this out. Even, you know, some of the smartest people in the most important executive agencies disagree on this question. Courts disagree on this question. How could you expect Steph Curry, who in the advertisement itself was saying, I don't know anything about crypto, I trust somebody else about it, to determine whether these are securities or not. But they may run up against the old adage that every lawyer learns in law school, which is that ignorance of the law is not a defense.
Why do you say that this is unlikely to get to a jury?
I think there is so much uncertainty on both sides, and there's a lot of money at stake. And I think the celebrities realize that they're the only solvent parties here. And so I think it's highly likely that this is the type of case that will settle before going to trial, like most cases do.
There may not be any other solvent parties besides these celebrities, but if you're talking about, what, thousands of people in this class action, what can they settle for that will satisfy a class like this?
That's the potentially billion-dollar question. I can't give a cogent answer on that, and I think that there are probably pretty intense discussions on this exact question going on between plaintiff's counsel and the various defense counsel in this case. It's anybody's guess what a number like that will look like.
A lot of litigation going on over FTX. Thanks so much, Shane. That's Shane Cipini of Cipini LLP. Coming up next on the Bloomberg Law Show, what do Jack Daniels, a squeaky dog toy, and Ginger Rogers have in common? I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.